Welcome to Dolly Reads for You with Dolly Howard, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you are live.
Okay, thanks. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is Wednesday. I'm trying to put Naughty Nook away so that I'm not naughty. And it is February 13, 2019. No, tomorrow's Valentine's Day, y'all. Don't forget to get your sweetie something. You're listening to Dolly Reads for You. There was something I was going to tell Nancy. I'm trying to remember what was it, but I can't remember. I'll tell her when I remember. We're reading Real Encounters, Different Dimensions, and Otherworldly Beings by Brad Steiger and Sherry Hansen Steiger. They're a married couple. Last week we got all the preliminaries done with the book, about the authors and the contents and all that stuff, and acknowledgments and credits. And so we started with chapter one, I think it's chapter one. Oh, we're in the introduction, I think. No, we read the introduction. Okay. Visitors from Extraterrestrial Worlds is what we're on right now. And here we are. Who is the alien? Oh, well, Nancy and I were talking to a couple aliens, and they like to be called family. So we should call them family, but the book says, who is the alien? Our dear friend Barbara May is a well-known astrologer who started her career as an accountant until she began studying the stars in 1967. Oh, yeah. I meant to mention to Nancy, I was thinking maybe I wasn't going to be on because she didn't put me in the list today. But I knew that she just had forgot, so I was just being silly.
What list?
In the chat room.
Huh?
For today's shows.
Yeah, they're... Yeah, I did. Well, I put you up right now. You're up now.
Yep, I'm up now. Better late than never.
No, I had you up early. I didn't put up the... Well, anyway, I'm putting them up as I get... They come up because... Anyway, you're up. I'm covering you, baby.
But see, in that first one... That first one, you didn't have me.
That's...
You went straight from Mona to... Expand your reality.
Oh, really? It wasn't in the, you know. Oh, that's right. It was weird. I don't know where your thing went. When I went to do it again, I said, "Where? What happened to Dolly?" No, I apologize. It wasn't there, and I have no clue as to why not. But anyway, I fixed it. It's up now, and it's also in the Facebook group. So,
oh, cool.
Apologize.
I didn't go to Facebook. Well, I did go to Facebook. I don't know why I didn't look it up there.
Well, why don't you?
I was so interested in all the other things that were being said.
Well, you got, if you don't see it and tell me, I don't know. Unless I fall into it later on. So I'm going to put it on you. Your fault. Walt's not here.
I wonder, is Mona still around? We can blame Mona. We blamed her about fish tank last night.
Yeah, people don't probably realize that we're talking about another show that we did last night.
Oh, yeah.
We just have these ongoing shows. They just kind of run one on into the other, you know?
They really do.
Sorry to interrupt you, but you had brought me into the conversation.
That's okay. I like to start the conversation with a different, I mean the book with a different conversation.
I just think that you should probably honor Brad. He died last March. March or May. Brad Steiger, the guy that's you're reading his book.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. Yeah, I looked him up because I thought in my mind, I said, gee, I think he died. And he did last year in the spring.
Aw. Well, how old was he?
He was up there. He's, you know, I said that I thought he was older than I am. I think he was, you know, mid-70s, maybe a little older even.
Wow.
For some reason, 82 is sticking in my mind, so I don't know.
He lived a good life then. He wrote this book.
He had a beautiful looking wife.
He did. They were a good looking couple.
Well, she's some kind of a model, apparently.
Oh, that's right. I did read that. Yeah. Forgot.
Good for him. Good for her. She got an exceptional man. And she must be special because he was. So it's good you're reading the book. But I just thought maybe you should know that. He's probably standing beside you, honey.
Oh, let me check. Hi, Brad. Dave's here. Hi, Dave. I love you, too. Dave said he had to come check out this guy who's here.
Oh, he is there.
He evidently is here. And, oh, yeah, he is. He says, thank you for reading my book. And he hopes that we enjoy it. Well, so far we're enjoying it, but of course we're only on page 17. But I think we'll enjoy it. The angels picked it for me, Brad. Dave can explain to you how that happens. Okay. Well, that's kind of nifty. I get these people who drop in, and even the angels at one time. I forgot. They came in for one show I was doing. Oh, I was reading that last book. And they came in because they wanted to add their viewpoint on it, too. And I had never had that happen to me before. I mean, they're always here. But I don't usually have three of them standing right here telling me about the
Well, I think they took things. Exception to something that was said, wasn't it?
I think that was it. And that's what brought them to me. Yeah, they're saying, yes, we had to set the record straight. My bedroom's getting crowded. I love it. I love this new place I'm at. I really do. I should check. Mom, are you here yet?
Oh, dear.
No, she's not here yet. I haven't heard anything from the estate, and so... I call that place where they all live, the estate, now. I decided to do that. What? Oh, on Dolly Shears that y'all haven't heard yet. Well, if you listen to Dolly Shears today at 7, you'll hear that. And I want to tell Aquarius that this Dolly Shears is dedicated to him because he asked me to do it and gave me specifics on what he wanted me to share, and I did. So this Dolly Shares today is dedicated to Aquarius. And thank you for your suggestion, Aquarius. I enjoyed doing it. Okay. Oh, I probably should tell everyone. My mother, I got this phone call from my cousin, and she and I were very close because we were Nancy lived with us most of the time. My cousin's name is Nancy, too. And she called. She was all upset. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what happened? So she says, well, we just got a call saying your mom is on her way out. She's not going to make it. And I thought, I looked at Annette and she looked at me and we thought, oh, here we go again. Every time I talk to my dad, my mom's not going to make it through the phone call. And so we found it a little hard to take seriously, but we tried to appease Nancy. And we were sitting at Walmart in the pickup zone because we always order our groceries and they bring them to us. And so we discussed it with each other and we weren't too upset about it. Because believe me, Mom needs to go. She's been in this vegetative type state where she walks and talks when she wants to for years. She gets up, sits in her chair. Well, my sister or father get her up, get her dressed, sit her in her chair. And that's where she is the rest of the day. And she sits there with her head hanging to the side and her mouth open. So that's the kind of vegetative state she's been in for years, 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 I'm telling you. But every time my dad calls, my mom's dying. So when my cousin called, bless her heart, she'd not gotten any of these calls before. She, of course, is very upset, and they live in Sarasota. Well, they're staying in their trailer camper in Sarasota at a campground, and Mom and Dad live in Venice, which is like a half hour away. So they were on their way to Venice. And so things went on. Nancy called me on their way back to their camper, and she said, well, I'll call him and let you know we're on our way back to Sarasota. And I said, okay, but thank you for all you've done and yada, yada, because of what went on during that day. And so Mom is still alive. This was on Sunday. My mother is 92 years old. Her grandma, her mother's mother, lived to be 102 years old. And she was cognizant until she took her last breath here. And grandma, my mother's mother, lived to be 98, I believe it was, cognizant to the day she left. And then there's this background story. My mom and I have this secret. She has been in that state for so many years because she can get away with it. When I come around and nobody's around, she opens her eyes, she's real alert, and she talks with me, and we have a good time and laugh together. And then my dad comes in and she's back to her head's to the side and her mouth's hanging open. So it's her way of escaping the lifestyle she didn't want to be living. She does have dementia. She's had that for a little while. But it wasn't debilitating. It might have gotten that way in the past few months. I'm not sure. I'm not there to see her. So anyway, that's why I wanted to check in to see if she had finally made it across that veil. If she had crossed the river and joined the spirit world. Nancy held the phone to her ear for me. And I said, Mom, if this is for real, please, just relax and go. Just relax. Let it happen. You're going from your family here on earth to your family who's already crossed over. Aunt Lois, her sister, her mama and daddy, they're all waiting for you. And I forgot to mention Uncle Buddy. That's her brother. But anyway, she knew. And Nancy said she got the tears and her face skewed up a little because she knew it was me. She always does that when she talks to me, especially when people are around, because she doesn't want them to know that she knows who I am, because she supposedly doesn't know anyone else. And so my kids have called and told her they love her, and they said their goodbyes. But anyway, I wanted to check to see if she finally made it, because I keep asking God, please take her, God. Please, please, please. She's so ready to go. She's been wanting to go for so long. Please let her cross over. But she hasn't yet. She will. One day she will, and then she'll be here with my other spirits who show up. Boy, speaking of my aunt and my uncle and grandma and grandpa, they're here too. Well, I love you too. They're all telling me how much they love me, and they're proud of me, and yeah, they're waiting for Mom. It isn't her time yet today. Okay. Well, thanks for coming. Oh, now that they know they can drop in anytime, they're going to be doing that. Thank you. I think I should read my book now. Okay. So, I paid my respects to everybody who's over there. Here's the section. Yes, Brad, yes, we're going to read your book now, okay? Oh, he's kind of enjoying. He got to meet some new beings over there now. They're going off. They're going to get to know each other. Well, isn't that sweet? That's special. Bye, y'all. Love you. Oh, the book. Let me get a drink. It's water today. Who is the alien? Our dear friend Barbara May is a well-known astrologer who started her career as an accountant until she began studying the stars in 1967. In 1976, she became professional astrologer, and she has never looked back. She is a native Californian who celebrated 50 years of marriage with her husband, Hoyt, in July 2012. My parents have been married, I'm 72, add to the 74 years now. Long time to be with somebody. They have two daughters, four granddaughters, and two great-grandchildren. She is as normal as blueberry pie. Ooh, that sounds good. I haven't had pie in a while. Blueberry pie. But in the early 1950s, Barbara had a very eventful day when, she believes, she encountered two aliens, and she herself was mistaken as an alien. Oh, wow. Here is her memory of that remarkable occasion. In January of 1954, my first husband, his best friend, my mother-in-law, and I drove from the Pasadena area in Southern California to a restaurant about halfway up Mount Palomar, where we heard a man named George Adamski, A-D-A-M-S-K-I, and she has in brackets 1891 to 1965, the first of the famous UFO contactees, end of brackets, who described his encounters with beings from outer space and sold a book that he'd written on the subject. I remember vividly starting the drive to climb that mountain road. I got very nauseous, and soon I was throwing up with my head hanging out the window. Oh, bless her, I did that when I was pregnant with Annette. Oh, bless her. Not a pleasant position to be in. This went on for about half an hour and was awful. Later I learned, with the only other pregnancy I ever had, she was pregnant, this was what I did when newly pregnant. I thought at the time I was tossing my cookies in fear of what we might see and hear. But 4 years later, I discovered that I throw up once with each pregnancy, and that's it. Oh, was she fortunate! I threw up about once every hour for months. When we reached the restaurant, I saw that the restrooms were outside, so I went into the ladies to clean up, wash my face, drink some water, and repair my hair and makeup. When I had refreshed myself, I joined the others in a large room where an older man with graying hair was talking about being in a spaceship, interacting with extraterrestrials and other outer space information. I had started seeing auras when I was around 5 years old. As I looked over the audience, I saw two auras that were totally different from any that I'd ever seen before. And they were right next to Mr. Adamski. That's how I'll say it. I apologize if I'm screwing up your name. The auras were very large, and at first I could not make out the faces or shapes of their bodies. Then I saw two young men that I judged to be in their early 20s, slender and quite tall when they stood up. They were staring at me intently, and I realized that they had sensed that I could see their auras. We had direct communication at that point. But although I was listening to Mr. Adamski, I was openly staring at these two strangers, who were strangers in a new way to me. Within a few minutes, those two strangers and I were sharing thoughts without speaking. Not a conversation, just the sharing. I settled down, directing my attention to Mr. Adamski, and the day passed with talking to others in the room during breaks. I noticed that the two young men with the strange auras never left Mr. Adamski's side. At one point, there was a definite break in the Q&A with Mr. Adamski, and I again went to the ladies' room outside. When I returned to the main room, I met a young man who asked me if I was from this planet. Oh, well, that's an unusual question. Let's see. He seemed half serious and half teasing. So the imp in me replied, "No, I'm from Venus." I like that woman. The young man got very pale and ran away from me. She scared him. I laughed, looked up, and saw the two young men with the strange auras looking at me and laughing with delight. I joined the laughter and went on my way back inside the restaurant. Were those two young men really from another planet? I've always thought so because in the 58 years since, I've traveled the world and never seen auras like the ones I saw that day coming from them. I recall in sharp relief everything that happened that day, the colors, the smells, and my feelings. I was never afraid of those two young men with the strange auras. They felt like old friends. I'm still laughing at that lady scaring that kid away. And that brought Brad back and the whole gang that was here before. They heard me laughing. Okay. I told you I was enjoying your book, Brad. Why do I recall that day so clearly after all this time? As a curious aside, the baby I was carrying nearly cost me my life as well as her own, and she's always been fascinated by science fiction. In fact, both of our girls are like that. I haven't told many people about this, just my husband, Hoyt. Here's another section. My Personal Encounter Story by Sean Castile. Sean Castile has written about UFOs, alien abduction, and related phenomena since 1989. Castile contributed regularly to Tim Beckley's magazine UFO Universe, eventually being given the title Associate Editor. He continued to write special reports and books for both of Beckley's publishing companies, Inner Light Publications and Global Communications. To date, Castile's book titles include UFOs, Prophecy and the End of Time, Nikola Tesla's Death Ray, and the Columbia Space Shuttle Disaster, and co-authored with Beckley, Our Alien Planet. This entire Earth, Castile's personal take on UFOs, is biblical, meaning, as he says, I believe the aliens are basically angelic creatures, not demons or mad scientists from outer space. I realize I am probably in a very small minority, but there it is. Likely many who come into the UFO field, or rather get dragged kicking and screaming into it, Sean Castile had no particular interest in UFOs or aliens, and would have sneered at anyone who did. But of course, that all changed once he had an encounter of his own, which he shares below. Okay, here's what he's sharing. I was 19 years old and living in Austin, Texas, working as a dishwasher while I tried to form a band to back me while I sang my own original songs. I was obsessed with the following in the path of Bob Dylan and writing lyrics that were genuinely poetic and meaningful. I was sharing an apartment with two other musicians, but not having much luck in assembling the needed players. One of my roommates suggested that a local fiddle player he knew might be interested in joining us. I was sitting in our living room one spring day in 1977 when the person I thought was the fiddle player knocked on our door and warmly greeted my roommate. The fiddle player was wearing very black sunglasses and cowboy boots with shorts. I'm getting an image of that in my head. Okay. Wearing very black sunglasses and cowboy boots with shorts. Not the height of fashion at the time. I wonder if it ever was. At that point, I was plunged into blackness. I had no idea what was going on. I began to hear a voice speaking to me telepathically, but I don't recall anything the voice actually said. I knew whatever it was reading my mind, and I became ecstatic at the thought that I could communicate so easily, that I could be understood completely without the effort to put things into words. Oh, I can't wait for that day to come again. I really have trouble with having to communicate out loud and make all the words go together in the right way and use the right words. And boy, that'll be nice. I have a very clear memory of looking into jet black eyes, which I assumed at the time were the dark sunglasses of the fiddle player. I now realize that the black eyes were more likely that of the standard gray alien. I also heard the repeated sound of a vault door slamming, which I read in later years was reported by other people as well. I haven't heard of that one. I remember conversing about my music for a little while, and I also recall moments of heart-pounding terror, though I don't remember any specific cause for that feeling. I somehow came out of the trance, or whatever it was, and was back in the living room. The fiddle player was leaving, and I could hear the grinding of the gears on his pickup truck, like something was wrong with his engine. The idea of that seemed to please me for some reason. When I spoke to one of my roommates from the Austin period 10 years later, in 1987, he told me that the other roommate had found me wandering around in the front yard, babbling incoherently the night following the living room telepathy encounter. I apparently hadn't been returned safely to the living room as I thought I was, but was missing for several hours and couldn't even speak intelligibly on my return. Needless to say, I was asked to find another place to live. Aw, I mean, here's a guy, he's and they kick him out? Oh. That isn't very nice. In 1982, I was living in Norman, Oklahoma, in a basement apartment near the campus of the University of Oklahoma. It was in the springtime, and I left my apartment to walk a short distance down the street to a pizza delivery place. I placed my order and then started walking back to my apartment to await the pizza. A voice spoke to me, saying something like, "Look up if you want to see something interesting." Ooh. So I looked up. And in the darkening sky above my apartment building, I saw two ships pass by in close formation, less than 50 yards from where I stood. They were shiny and metallic, one a bright green and the other a polished gold color. Their shape is hard to describe, but they weren't the standard disc shape or cigar shape. They were completely silent except for the slightest sound of the wind passing around them as they flew. My next recollection is of waking up in my bed the next day. I never got the pizza, and I'm sure the delivery person was miffed that I wasn't there to pay him anything or give him a tip. I realize now, after more than 20 years of studying the UFO and alien abduction phenomena, that these are the exact kinds of experiences, including the amnesia associated with certain aspects of them, that are often studied under regressive hypnosis in order to retrieve those minutes or hours of missing time. During one of my many conversations with the late abduction research pioneer Bud Hopkins, he advised me not to submit to regressive hypnosis, even though he used it all the time, because after so many years of researching abduction myself, I probably wouldn't be able to trust what I remembered. I would quite naturally think I was at least partially generating the mental images, etc., from unconscious memories of my own research, and would be plunged into even worse doubt and uncertainty about what had happened. Bud said that unless not knowing what happened to me was disrupting my life, I should just leave it all alone. It was reading Whitley Strieber's Communion in 1989 that led to the first real breakthrough for me, and I'll always be grateful for having the presence of mind to check it out of the local library in Norman, Oklahoma. I suddenly realized that so much of the high strangeness of my life since the experience in Austin was also happening to millions of other people, and we were all just beginning to explore a completely different reality that was both terrifying and beautiful. Somewhere along the line. I read that the initial I'm hearing myself, Nancy. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm okay. Somewhere along the line, I read that the initial experience with this kind of paranormal thing is almost always viewed in negative terms because of the extreme shock involved in realizing that this other reality even exists at all. Something the late Harvard psychiatrist Dr. John Mack called ontological shock. And the subsequent uncomfortable realignment of everything you formerly held to be true. After I got my journalism degree at the University of Oklahoma, I did freelance work for some local newspapers. But after reading Whitley's Communion and Bud's Intruders, most of my writing concerned itself with UFOs and alien abduction. That has been the case for many years now. I still don't know what memories are there, hiding just beneath the surface. To this day, I have no memory of seeing a gray alien even once, beyond the grip of those large black eyes I saw in Austin. I can only hope that the overall experience is happening for a good reason and that people are being chosen to take part in some kind of blessed transformation of this planet and ourselves, leading to something like the paradise that is promised at the end of the book of Revelation, where God will actually come to dwell alongside mankind. Perhaps the New Jerusalem will be a large, bejeweled ship from out there somewhere. Once you allow for aliens in the mix, anything becomes possible. Well, in the Bible, it does say that the New Jerusalem will come down from the heavens. Very interesting. I never thought about that before, the way I'm thinking about it now, that the New Jerusalem will come down from the heavens. Wow. Wow. Okay, new section. Real encounters are learning experiences. We believe that if there are paraphysical beings who walk among us, they may have the ability to influence the human mind telepathically in order to protect what may appear to be three-dimensional images. The image seen may depend in large part upon the preconceptions the human observer has about alien life forms. Thus, reported accounts of spaceship occupants run the gambit from bug-eyed monsters to little green men to metaphysical space brothers to slender young men with large auras. Although we may not perceive these intelligences in their true form, if indeed they even possess physical forms, it seems clear that most people would be more likely to communicate with a visitor that is fairly conventional in appearance, and that once human attention has been attracted, the intelligence mechanism of the other could quite easily alter human consciousness. We believe that many of the chance encounters that occur between human witnesses and the other are in reality learning experiences for the human percipients. That is, they were designed to assist the percipients to become aware that humankind is not alone in the universe or on this planet. After extensive research, we have come to the conclusion that it may not really matter who perceives the many divergent beings fashioned by the multidimensional intelligence. The important thing is that someone acknowledges and interacts with them on either a conscious or an unconscious level. Well, that was a nice chapter. Ready to start the next one? Let me take a drink. This is really... This is different for me. I'm sitting here reading this book with you. At the same time, I've got the three angels standing next to me on the left side. I've got my aunt and uncle, grandma and grandpa, Brad and Dave on the right side, and at the right foot of my bed. And everybody seems to be talking to me. But yet, I'm being able to understand what each one is saying to me. And I'm kind of being able to respond to them, yet understand what I'm reading. Another new experience for me, y'all, and you're witnessing it. I think I kind of like this place where I'm at right now. Okay, the new chapter is Contact with Space Brothers and Sisters. In the previous chapter, Barbara May told of having attended a seminar by George Adamski when she was a young woman in 1954. Adamski, 1891 to 1965, was the first of the New Age UFO prophets to gain national and international attention. According to his account, just as the prophets of old went out into the desert to receive their revelations directly from God or the angels, Adamski went out into the night near Desert Center, California, on November 20, 1952, and received his first encounter with Orthon, that's O-R-T-H-O-N, a Venusian space brother. Their communication occurred through telepathic transfer, and Adamski learned that the space traveler had come in peace and that he was greatly concerned with the spiritual growth of humankind. After Adamski published Flying Saucers Have Landed, co-authored with Desmond Leslie, he became popular as a lecturer, as our friend Barbara May witnessed firsthand. Seriously. Yep, it's my son. I'm not answering. Let's see. Their communication occurred through telepathic transfer, and Adamski learned that the space traveler had come in peace and that he was greatly concerned with the spiritual growth of humankind. After Adamski published Flying Saucers Have Landed, co-authored with Desmond Leslie, he became popular as a lecturer, as our friend Barbara May witnessed firsthand. Flying saucer mania was rampant in the early 1950s, with steady sightings of unidentified flying objects keeping the rampant rumors about the alleged saucer crash in Roswell, New Mexico, in 1947, ever in public awareness. There was an eager segment of the population who wanted to know who was piloting the mysterious craft in the sky, where they were from, what they looked like, and whether they were friendly or hostile. Adamski had the answers. Orthon had come in peace, eager to warn Earthlings about radiation from the nuclear tests that were being conducted. There were universal laws and principles established by the Creator of all, and the people of Earth would do well to begin to practice those laws at once. Adamski described the space brother as smooth-skinned, beardless, with shoulder-length blonde hair, who stood about 5 feet 6 inches tall and wore what appeared to be some kind of jumpsuit-like uniform. Oh, I got two pages. Hold on. Adamski received the first of the messages telepathically, but later, after he had been taken for a trip into outer space, he was able to communicate verbally with such entities as Furkan, the Martian, and Ramu from Saturn, as well as his friend Orthon. They got a picture of him here, of George and the Venusian person in the spaceship. Huh. George is an older man, white hair, very good looking. The death of George Adamski on April 23, 1965, by no means terminated the heated controversy that had never stopped swirling around the prolific and articulate contactee. Throughout his career as a contactee, Adamski's believers steadfastly declared him to be one of the most saintly of men, completely devoted to the teachings of universal laws. After his death, a number of his followers provided their discipline of intergalactic peace with a kind of instant resurrection. In the book, The Skoriton, S-C-O-R-I-T-O-N, Mystery, by Eileen Buckle, a contactee named Ernest Bryant claims to have met three spacemen on April 24, 1965. That's the day after George died. One of whom was a youth named Yamsky, whose body already housed the reincarnated spirit of George Adamski. Oh! Wow. Wow. Adamski's desert encounter with a Venusian and Robert Weiss's motion picture The Day the Earth Stood Still, with its warning from the alien messenger Klaatu that the people of Earth had better clean up their act, were probably the two most contributive factors in birthing the UFO contactee movement in the United States. I always liked that show, The Day the Earth Stood Still. I liked that big guy. And then when he showed up as my guardian angel, I bet I pictured him that way because I like Klaatu so much. It was in my reality. Very interesting. Okay, new section. Profile of a UFO contactee and the cosmic gospel. UFO contactees are men and women who are convinced that they have encountered alien space intelligences and that they remain in direct communication with them through telepathic thought transference. The contact experience with the Space Brothers and Sisters follows very much the same pattern all over the world. Number one, the contactees first saw a UFO on the ground, hovering low overhead. Sometimes they report having heard a slight humming sound above them, which drew their attention to a mysterious craft. Number two, a warm ray of light emanated from the craft and touched the contactees on the neck, the crown of the head, or the middle of the forehead where the third eye of higher awareness is located. Many state that they lost consciousness at this point, and upon awakening may have discovered that they could not account for anywhere from a minute or two to an hour or two of their time. Number three, none of the flying saucer contactees report feeling any fear of their solar brothers and sisters, and most of them eagerly look forward to a return visit from them. The contactees agree that the space beings' most prominent characteristic is wisdom, and they seem to take their space siblings' scientific knowledge for granted. If they have traveled through space from other worlds to Earth, then they have to be extremely and sublimely intelligent. Number four. After the initial contact experience, nearly all contactees seem to suffer through several days of restlessness, irritability, sleeplessness, and unusual dreams or nightmares. Many contactees are told that they were selected for contact because they really are aliens or hybrids who were planted on Earth as very small children. They were advised that their cosmic abilities will soon begin to manifest. In some cases, UFO researchers have observed that there does seem to be a heightening of what one would normally consider manifestations of extrasensory perception after the contact experience with an alleged benevolent space being. Along with psychic abilities, the contactee is often left with a timetable of certain predictions of future events. Number five. Family and friends of the contactees report that they appear to be changed persons after their alleged experience with the space beings. Number six. After a period of a week to several months, the contactee who has received a message from the space beings feels compelled to go forth and share it with others. The essence of the cosmic gospel of the Space Brothers contains such concepts as the following. Now, this is a new subject here. It's the essence of the cosmic gospel of the Space Brothers contains such concepts as the following. Number one, humankind is not alone in the solar system, and what humans do somehow affects the entire universe. After the explosions of atomic bombs in 1945 signaled that Earth had entered the nuclear age, brothers and sisters from outer space have come to Earth to help those humans who will listen to their promise of a larger universe and heed their warnings to become better caretakers of the planet. Number two. The space beings want humankind to become eligible to join an intergalactic spiritual federation. Ooh, number three. The space beings have come to assist the people of Earth to lift their spiritual vibratory rate so they may enter new dimensions, in parentheses. According to the space beings, Jesus, Krishna, Confucius and many of the other leaders of the great religions came to Earth to teach humanity these very same abilities. End of parentheses. Number four. The citizens of Earth stand now in a transitional period before the dawn of a new age of peace, love, and understanding. Boy, I can believe that, especially with things that are going on these days. We really do seem to be headed in a oneness. I don't know if it's good or bad. I'm going to say it's good. In my reality, it's all good. Okay, number five. If the Earthlings should not raise their vibratory rate within a set period of time, severe Earth changes and major cataclysms will take place, and a larger portion of the human population will be destroyed. It's the end of the 1 through 5. In spite of such setbacks as public humiliations, when unfulfilled prophecies have received wide publicity and do not come to pass, A good many of the contactees continue to be imbued with an almost religious fervor to spread the message that has been given to them by the space beings. Some researchers have observed that the space beings appear to function as do the angels of more conventional theologies. Both beings are concerned about Earth, and they seem to be actively trying to protect it and the people on it. Both the space beings and the angels are entities who appear to have control over the physical limitations of time and space. Yet they are benevolent in their actions toward humankind. It seems that space beings have deliberately placed themselves in the role of messengers of God, which is the biblical definition of the word angel. I've got some angels who are peeking in the bedroom door. You know how you peek around a door frame? I got several of them peeking around door frame wanting to know what the other three, what's going on in here? Oh my gosh. My room is really getting full. But it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful they let me be able to feel this, to see this, to hear it. I'm very blessed. I am very blessed. George Mantassel, 1910 to 1978, published his first booklet in 1952 and introduced the world to Ashtar, commandant of Station Share, said to be one of several saucer stations in BLAAU, the fourth sector of Bella, BELA, into which our solar system is moving. Mantassel, operator of the Giant Rock Airport in California's Mojave Desert, received most of this information directly from the Council of Seven Lights, a group of discarnate Earthlings inhabiting a spaceship orbiting our planet. You know, I can't believe this. I'm reading this stuff. Last year, if I was reading this stuff, I'd think I'd gone completely bonkers. And with all the stuff going on in my bedroom right now, I have come a long way from where I was. I wondered, have you all done that too? Really interesting. So to me, what I'm reading now is very, okay, in a very commonplace, ordinary. Yes, it should be. Oh. Okay. He received these messages when he went into a trance while sitting at the base of the huge rock that gave the region its name. Shan, S-H-A-N, was the name that Mantassel's contact gave for planet Earth. Mantassel's Ashtar also decreed the universe to be ruled by the Council of Seven Lights, which had divided the cosmos into sector systems and sectors. So they call, contact gave, Shan was the name that Mantassel's contact gave for the planet Earth. Mantassel founded the Ministry of Universal Wisdom based on his revelations of the Space Brothers. This ministry teaches the universal law, which operates on humankind in seven states: gender, male and female. This is the states now that he's going to name. He doesn't mean states like United States. He means the name of different, well, you'll see as I read it on. Gender, male and female. The creator as cause. Polarity of negative and positive. Vibration, rhythm. Ruled by the Council of Seven Lights, which had divided the cosmos into sector systems and sectors. On August 24, 1952, an alien named Solgonda invited Van Tassel to travel aboard a spaceship. When Van Tassel returned to Earth, he knew that it would be his special mission to host space conventions at Giant Rock. And this, the genial, colorful contactee did until his death in 1978. During his lifetime, he also found time to travel the United States, presenting nearly 300 lectures, wow, and appearing on over 400 radio and television programs. Boy, my tongue is getting lazy. New section called Similarities Between Space Contactees and Spiritual Mediums.
Do you want to take a break first?
Oh, yeah, that'd be nice. I didn't even think about time. I got so much going on here.
Well, I was trying to figure out which music to pick, and at that point you told me that you had some angels peeking around the corner.
Yeah.
And I'm going, why would angels have to peek around a corner? It sounded so absolutely stupid to me. But then I realized that I was going back and forth between a couple, three songs, and the one that they want me to play is In the Arms of an Angel. 4 minutes and 24 seconds.
Aw, thanks.
All your time waiting for that second chance, for a break that would make it okay. There's always some reason to feel not good enough, and it's hard at the end of the day. I need some distraction. Oh, maybe empty, oil weightless, and maybe I'll find some peace tonight. In the arms of the angel, fly away from here, from this dark. Sadness that brings me to
And you're back.
I was muted. I mean, by me.
Well, oddly enough, I had you muted, too. We both came off at the same time.
Well, thank you for that song. Okay, similarities between space contactees and spirit mediums. Although most of the contactees claim an initial physical contact with a space being, the operable mechanics of the experience seem very reminiscent of what can be seen in spiritualism when the medium works with a spirit guide or a control from the other side. In spiritualistic or mediumistic channeling, the medium enters the trance state, not me, and relays information from the guide, the entity who contacts various spirits from the other side. The mechanism in the flying saucer movement is very often that of the contactee going into some state of trance and channeling information from space beings. I refuse to have anyone take over my body. So I don't do that. I just go straight to whoever wants to talk to me. Okay. Because the trigger mechanism that the facets of the other employ in making contact has something to do with the psychological state of the individual contactee, subjective elements invariably infuse mystic and paranormal experiences into the experience. I'm being told I'm such a control person. I just want to be in control of my body. Hold on. Perhaps the most revealing mythic giveaway in UFO contactee cases pointed out by such researchers as Michael Talbot, 1953 to 1992, didn't live very long, is the delivering of the cosmic gospel. Many UFO entity encounters feature figures suggestive of various spiritual avatars who appear to exhibit the characteristics of divine revelation. The entity's avowed purpose for appearing to the witness is to convey a sort of heavenly message, or orgalog, O-R-G-A-L-O-G-U-E. In his thought-provoking paper, A Mile to Midsummer, Talbot refers to such phenomena as appearances of the Virgin Mary, fairies, and so forth, as protein psychoid. Talbot states that they are protein, P-R-O-T-E-A-N, because they are all part of the same chameleon-like phenomena that changes to reflect the belief structures of the time. He goes on to say that they are psychoid in that they are paraphysical phenomenon that are related to the psychological state of the observer. Talbot states that it is the subjective and paraphysical aspect of UFOs that sheds the most light on their nature. If UFOs appear to be totally a physical phenomenon, Talbot points out, it would be easier to deal with them as extraterrestrial or even ultra-terrestrial. An astronomer does not experience headaches, strange voices, visions, or poltergeist phenomena every time he discovers a red-shifted galaxy. The phenomenon with which astronomers and the majority of scientists deal are objective and physical. The paraphysical nature of UFOs has always suggested that they are somehow less real than red-shifted galaxies, Talbot comments. In any case, three facts remain. One, people are experiencing UFO phenomenon and contacts. Number two, the phenomenon strongly suggests an objective nature. Number three, the phenomenon also strongly suggests a subjective nature. Nancy, those angels that were peeking in, now they're standing up in the wall. I see right through The fact that we have not been able to resolve the conflict between their subjective and objective nature indicates that perhaps the only conflict is in our assumptions concerning experience. Not only must UFOs be considered in both their subjective and objective light, that is, as an omnijective phenomenon, but the categories of real and unreal become meaningless. Oh, that's perfect timing for those angels that are standing in the wall. Real and unreal. The wall becomes real and unreal. All right, thank you. Now, new section, the silent contactees. It is impossible to estimate how many men and women claim to receive messages from space beings. Groups continue to rise from dynamic contactees, each with their variations of previous revelations and their own occasional individual input. There is also the category of revelators that UFO researchers term the silent contactees, men and women who have not gathered groups about them, but who have established contact with what they feel to be entities from other worlds, and who have directed their lives according to the dictates of those space beings. Many of these men and women continue to work in conventional jobs, confiding their experiences only to close associates and family members. We would term Don Avery a silent contactee. He has been active in civic life in his community. He is a former Democrat, candidate for county commissioner in Flatland County, Montana. Administrator. Oh, he's an administrator, those two. He quietly reaches the phenomena of contact by using his own experience as the case study. He told us that he does not travel the country advertising himself as a channel for the Space Brothers. He has prepared the Below UFO Diary especially for this book. Jeez. I'm hesitating because I'm kind of lightheaded. Okay, and that's home today, too. She's homesick. Here's the UFO diary. Kingman and Parker, Arizona. Winters of 2010 through 2012 UFO sightings by Don Avery. The time frame was mid-April 2010. My wife Peggy and I had recently arrived in Kingman, Arizona to pick up a fifth-wheel trailer. This was just a few days before the BP oil well blowout. I was standing behind the trailer in a KOA campground, taking a photo for use in a book being published by Brad Steiger, dealing with various real monsters. I was one of the contributors. The BP blowout was in 2010. I thought it was a lot longer ago than that. Well, while waiting for my wife to retrieve the camera for the photo, I noticed a sharp glint or reflection in my eyes coming from above and slightly to the left. I observed that an object was slowly ascending. It did not have wings or emit any noticeable emissions. It was also silent. Having been down this road many times before, I attempted to grasp an idea of time loss. Contactees often report missing time during their visits from the communicating entity. It couldn't have been much, maybe a few minutes, but they don't need much. I knew that they had something for me. Oh, there's a nice picture coming up from the water. The attitude of the star people toward the oil spill was one of complete outrage. I was quite surprised to see the level of emotion that was displayed by these entities. I'm not surprised one bit. I'm with them. These beings are very dark, red, brown, and fairly large in stature. I'm guessing 5'9" to 5'11". I was 10 at my first encounter experience, and the smallest of the entities was about an inch taller than me. They claim that the well disaster in the Gulf of Mexico was already underway, and that BP had lied and was down some 40,000 feet under the seafloor, creating a long-term disaster that even they, star people, could not repair. There is now long-term geological damage to the seafloor, and the consequences could be devastating. Amen there. They're still going on. I lived over there. Humankind has been a poor steward of this planet, and the star people are so angry about this current disaster that they don't know what to do next. They will consult with the other groups of star people who are utilizing this planet. I wanted to know what they expected me to do about all of this. Why are you venting at me? I was told, we will be back. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, we'll be back. I was instructed to continue paying attention to these things and to prepare. I then realized that after the last visit that I remember, July 2008, I earnestly began to store and prepare for almost any eventuality. In fact, I have stored up food and necessary survival items for almost 20 years. I got the impression that they were deceived by BP and our government, and that there was some serious retribution coming our way. On January 12, 2011, I was driving from the RV park that we were staying at in Parker Dam, Arizona, to Parker, a distance of 15 miles. I left at 11:30 a.m. and arrived in Parker at approximately 12:15 p.m. The speed limit was 50 miles per hour. The drive normally takes 17 to 18 minutes. I remember leaving and arriving, but that's about it. I'm missing 20 to 25 minutes. My wife, Peggy, watched a disc hovering above the Colorado River below Parker Dam for several minutes in mid-February 2011, after dark, around 9:30 p.m. She came running into our fifth-wheeler, all excited. When she ran back outside, it was still there, hovering across the river from us. I experienced a stationary object hovering silently over the desert near Parker, Arizona, on October 27, 2011. It was stationary for several minutes and had a number of flashing lights. It exited in a blur of speed. I'm not aware of time lost. My wife spotted a stationary red light over our area on the night of January 13, 2012. She seems to spot peculiar night light displays about once a week in the Arizona skies during the winter. Oh, he drew a picture. On January 14, 2012, at approximately 6:20 p.m., I went for a walk around the south half of the RV park where we are spending the winter on the Colorado River near Parker, Arizona. I had covered about two-thirds of the route when I noticed a bright reddish light off to the west over the river. At first, I thought that it might be a planet that I had failed to notice earlier because there was some light cloud cover. But the clouds slid behind it, and a commercial jet was high overhead above it. Its height is hard to estimate, maybe 1,200 to 1,500 feet. It was slowly sliding south and gave off no emissions. Uh-oh, doo-doo-doo-doo. It did not have any appendages or emit any sound. It began to ascend as I rounded the corner en route to our fifth-wheeler. It was now dark. At that point, I saw another one, or maybe the same one, off to the north about 1/2 mile from where I saw the first one. This one was very bright, lower in altitude, and sliding west above the park to our northwest. I yelled at my wife to come outside. We both watched it for several minutes. I grabbed the camera, but at this point, it was starting to ascend. It was identical to the first one that I saw. That's 4 sightings in 2 days. What gives? I'm not aware of any time lost. On January 18, 2012, at 7:06 p.m., I stepped out of our fifth-wheeler when I observed a glowing red light hovering to the north at about 1,000 feet. It made no sound or emissions. I beckoned to my wife to come and watch. We both observed it for about a minute before it ascended and disappeared. I have bought a new camera and came close to getting a photo. If it keeps showing up, I will get a picture of this craft. This also occurred on the 29th of January, but it was not close enough to get a decent picture. Well, that's true, because when I took the picture of the Enterprise by the moon, it wasn't real decent, but we could make out the shadow form of it. I like how he gets this, he says approximate, but he gets the exact minute down when he tells us a time. February 8, 2018, at 7:15 p.m., my wife called me outside to observe a light moving across the eastern sky, north to south. It was silent and exhibited no emissions or appendages. It proceeded parallel to us, ascended, and then made a 90-degree turn and headed east. You can't see much, just a light. I will use a telephoto the next time. The moving light is at the center of the photo and is the largest light. On Friday, February 10, 2012, at approximately 7:45 p.m., this guy must look at his watch all the time to know what time it is when he's talking to his wife. Oh, come out and look at this. Well, I wouldn't be able to tell you what time it was if my life depended on it. On Friday, February 10, 2012, at approximately 7:45 p.m., my wife and I watched a reddish light approaching us from the northwest at a slow rate of speed. It stopped and hovered for several minutes and then headed north at a rapid rate of speed. It seems that we see this type of light every couple of weeks. What it is, I do not know, but I made a sketch of what it appeared to resemble through binoculars. The sketch is here in the book. It looks like a bell. Looks exactly like a bell without the clapper in the bottom. On Saturday, February 25, 2012, at 7:14 p.m., we were driving back from having dinner out and spotted a reddish light off to the north. By the time I parked the truck and retrieved the camera, it had accelerated to the north and disappeared. This event replicates many of the other sightings reported in this blog. On Sunday, April 1st, 2012, at about 12:05 p.m., I was out for a walk, heading north to a marina and restaurant located on the Colorado River, about 1/4 mile north of the RV park where we are spending the winter. As I rounded the end of the marina, I noticed a silver object above the California side of the river. Based upon the height of the adjoining hills, I would place its elevation at 5,000 to 6,000 feet and horizontal distance at about 1/2 mile. The time was 12:23 p.m. I'm surprised he doesn't put seconds. I watched it for about 45 seconds as it slid to the southwest and began to ascend. It had a top or upper deck. It did not have any wings. No emissions were evident, and it made no noise that I could hear. I returned home, arriving at 12:32 p.m., I'm missing about 8 to 9 minutes. From almost 60 years of contact experience, I can assure others of several things, and he lists four of them. Number one, there is something coming our way. What and when, I do not know. But I think that our government has a feel for this and has constructed a number of underground facilities that they think are safe havens for whatever awaits us. I have some bad news for them. Your best chance is topside. Don't be a mole in a hole with nowhere to go. I always thought that too. I wouldn't want to go underground. Number two, this group of star people, do not communicate with our government because of the extreme level of corruption. Oh, imagine that. Number three, they cannot stand being lied to. They absolutely abhor it. They prefer putting up with my bad attitude and previous efforts to engage in extreme violence than being jerked around by a species of beings that barely registers on the intelligence scale. Whatever you do, stand up straight and get counted. They may not like it, but they will respect it. Number 4. They do have their tolerance level. I feel a very ancient connection to them. I believe that many of our life experiences are predicated upon prenatal accords in an effort to advance ourselves in a very positive sense. Those that revert to prior conduct have a very serious problem. There is no place to hide. Stand up strong and be true to honesty and yourself, no matter what the consequences. In the long run, you will advance. Don and his wife Peggy have a blog. Wow. PreppingMadeEasy.blogspot.com, in which they demonstrate a 10-step process to help individuals think their way through any emergency. Don has another blog, destroyedbyoil.blogspot.com, that deals with all kinds of interesting experiences, ranging from Bigfoot and the paranormal to conspiracy theories and articles related to health issues and history. It has had many thousands of visitors. Oh, I turned the page and this picture scared me for a minute. It's of an alien with a elongated head and the big black eyes, and it's black and white. Black and white. By hand type picture. Hand drawn, that's what I'm trying to think of. Thank you. New section called He Communicates with His Brother on Another Planet. Oh, wow. I need a drink. Boy, that's good Shanghai water. I'm telling you, nothing tastes as good as Shanghai water. Our good friend Tom T. Moore of Plano, Texas, surprised us when he told us that he was in touch with his brother on another planet. Over the past 40 years, we have interviewed dozens of men and women who claim to be in regular communication with space intelligences. But in this case, the contactee was a man that Brad had known for more than 30 years and who we considered a very down-to-earth businessman. Surprise! Now, we did know that Tom had always been interested in mystical and spiritual explorations and had quite recently published a book and established a website titled The Gentle Way, a self-help guide for those who believe in angels. Ooh! But now we had a serious Texas gentleman telling us that he had established contact with an amphibian gentleman on another planet. We had to learn more, and Tom was generous to his usual standard of benevolently expecting great things. And he allowed us to include in this book a portion of his forthcoming book on his conversations with Antura in the Sirius B star system. So it's titled Conversations with My Brother on Another Planet by Tom T. Moore. In July of 2005, I discovered that I could communicate with other beings while in a light alpha altered state. This took place during a seminar put on by the master hypnotist Richard Sutphen, S-U-T-P-H-E-N, who is well known for his books on past lives. I had decided to try and communicate with an American Indian shaman living in the western United States during the 1600s by the name of Reveals the Mysteries. He had been channeled for me by my friend Robert Shapiro. When Richard put us under, ostensibly to try our hand at automatic writing, I thought in my mind, reveals the mysteries. Are you there? He responded, yes, I am, Tom. And I thought to myself, wow. He went on to tell me, I was an Indian shaman by the name of Stillwater, living at that same time, and I had decided to reintroduce people to the gentle way in the 20th and 21st centuries. That became the title of my first book from that very first conversation with Reveals the Mysteries. Later, I would begin to communicate with Gaia, the soul of the earth, and my own guardian angel, whom I named Theo. As he said, our vocal cords were not made to say angelic names. Theo told me we can communicate with anyone, anywhere in the universe because we receive thought packets, which we filter according to our education, knowledge, and spiritual beliefs. But it's even easier if the person is part of your soul group, or cluster, as Theo calls them, which on average is 6 to 12 fragments of your soul. Reveals the Mysteries turned out to be part of my soul cluster. A couple of years later, I was communicating with Theo in meditation one morning on the subject of ancient ET ruins on Earth, and Theo told me, they will be able to point these artifacts out to you at some future point. I asked if he meant you generally or you personally. He responded, it will be you personally, Tom. You will have the privilege of meeting a Syrian one day. He then asked if I would like to speak to him as he was turning in to us. After I got over the surprise that we were on a party line and not having a confidential conversation, I declined and said I would put together some questions for my next meditation. And thus began many, many questions for my soul cluster, brother, living a life in the Sirius B star system. I would have difficulty receiving his name correctly for several weeks. First it was Antu, then Anturara, and finally one day he almost shouted out the word, thought packet-wise. He means, in parentheses, thought packet-wise. Anturara. He explained that we had several lives together, the last one being in Atlantis. He said he had more lives on Earth after that, not just with me. Anturara. I would have another big surprise after we began communicating. I had always heard first public contact would be with people that looked just like us, probably the Palladians. So naturally, I assumed since he would be coming to see us, he would appear just like any Earth human, more or less. In one of our early conversations, I was asking him about his planet, and he explained that it had a small landmass, with most of the planet covered by water. I then asked if he lived on land or in the ocean, and he replied he was a water being, an amphibian. He likes the term coined by the host of a radio show I appeared on, Aquaman. He likes Aquaman. If you saw any of the Hellboy movies, there is an amphibian character by the name of Abe Sapien. If you do a search for images from that movie, you'll get as close as we possibly can to a photographic description of him. He has, phew, hold on, I gotta breathe. I'll get a drink of water. Dave's telling me, I always tell you to breathe. I hear you, I hear you. He has gills behind rounded ears. He has strikingly beautiful, he says, blue skin, tinged with white and yellow to blend with the ocean for protection in their early lives on the planet. Ooh, that sounds really pretty. His eyes are round, but smaller than the Zeta eyes, with eyelids and a smaller nose. He has four digits, no thumbs, as they say they don't need them, and four toes. Naturally, they are webbed. They're vegetarians and not oxygen breathers. And Tura says they live to be 1,200 to 1,500 years old, as their lives are not as difficult as ours. Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful, y'all? He is already between 450 and 500 years of age. Oh, that would be horrible, though. I was saying, wouldn't it be nice if we had a life not as difficult as ours? I don't want to live for that long. At least not in this lifetime. Maybe I do in a different one. They do excrete waste, just not as often as we do. Their female typically do not have children until after their, 125th year, and no periods until they are ready to conceive. Oh, I want to be one of them. Gestation is 6 months to birth their little tadpoles, as he humorously says. They sleep a little less than Earth humans and dream, as do most beings in the universe. Their universal greeting is to wish a long life or good life. They were amused at the Star Trek greeting, but I still like it. That was in parentheses. And Tura's water planet is one of the more than 20 planets in the Sirius B star system. Only 10 to 12% of the planet is landmassed, and there are beings that live on the land, which they are friends with. Their city is approximately 1 mile below the surface, with a large percentage of it dry, but also many places with access to water. He and his family live in what we would consider an apartment building, as is typical, it seems, of other societies in the universe. They do not play competitive games, as that involves negativity. He says that's what Earth people will bring to the rest of the universe: small amounts of negativity, typically 0.2% to 2% maximum. Even though it will be several hundred years, this seems to make them nervous. We're supposed to be the catalyst to get these societies moving again to raise their vibrational levels. I thought they would be at 5.85 on the fifth focus frequency scale, but was told it was more like 5.35. And his planet has been inhabited for around 18 million years. Judas priest. He said, I originated on that planet. And in fact, was one of the first souls to have a life there. He also said, I was one of the first to have a life on Earth. It seems each life I have is as some sort of spiritual master, as that is my soul's main interest. He further stated that my next life will be back on the water planet before my next Earth life, as a female space pilot of one of 17 Earth starships in the 3400 era.
Wow.
And Tura said, we will not begin traveling to the stars until around 3250. One Earth ship will actually leave for one of the nearer star systems without the advantage of portal hopping, as Antura calls it, but will be rescued by one of the very first starships using portals to travel a few years later. My mind's going many directions on that one. He explains that you cannot go from one side of the universe to the other with one portal hop. It takes several. He compared it to Southwest Airlines going from one part of the United States to the other, making three or four stops. When I expressed surprise at the comparison, he explained that they know everything about us, having studied us for years and years. The best explanation I could get out of him is that there are folds in space. I asked for a better explanation, and he said he could not, as our scientists must figure that out themselves. He said to imagine waves in the ocean. So why did he contact me? He's part of a first contact team that contacts other planets as they find them all over the universe. I asked him what was the last planet he performed this duty on, and he said it was a planet inhabited by what we might call sloths. They're a few thousand years away from more development, but they like to introduce themselves at an early stage. They somehow use the form of a wise sloth so as not to frighten the local population. When asked what was his background that made him ideal for the first contact team, he said he had lived 800 lives on Earth. Oh, wow. And that had given him the gift of gab. It seems he does grassroots type contacts as compared to the team members who work with governments and scientists, which is where I come in, since I'm one of his soul cluster brothers. He said he planned to meet with me and two other people when they come in 2017. Ooh, I wonder if they did meet. This is the Tom guy, isn't it? Yep, Tom T. Moore. They come in 2017, 2 years after the Pleiadians, who do look just like us, make first public contact in Europe in 2015. One of the other people is a lady living in Provence in southern France. She's also a member of our soul cluster. He says, I have even visited the town during my many trips to Cannes as part of my international film and TV program distribution business. The other person lives in Asia and is not a soul cluster member, but Antura has had a number of lives with him on Earth. So I thought this will be interesting, getting to meet a real-life alien. He explained that I would be given instructions to go to a remote location where he would meet me. Naturally, I asked if I could have a ride in the scout craft, which he described as typically saucer-shaped, about 40 feet in diameter, and capable of carrying 5 to 8 passengers. He said, of course I could. Now, after hundreds of more questions, I've discovered that I'll actually go to his mothership and stay for a month or two, if I wish, getting to know all the crew members. He says that the mothership, which is thousands of years old, holds 700 to 1,000 crew members. He told me my senses would be an overload as there will be so many different types of ETs I'll meet, mostly from the Sirius B system, but others too, including two reptilians, who like to stay to themselves. He explained that several million years ago there was a real Star Wars started by the reptilians. It was really nasty, as instead of blowing up a planet as we'd seen in the sci-fi movies, they would blow up the sun, destroying all the planets in that solar system. And this went on for several thousand universal years, which are different from Earth years. Finally, peace came again. Supposedly, I had a hand in the peace process during one of my spiritual master lives. I suggested that the reptilians be allowed to take part in the Earth experiment by providing souls, too. I've been told that one of my current friends has a reptilian soul and was put in my path so that I could see how they're faring. Only fair. He wants to bring them here, he can meet them. Recently, I found that we would also visit our moon in Antura's scout craft. We'll probably go to the conventional... Oh no, I read that wrong. We'll probably go the conventional way of a speedy trip there, and then he'll demonstrate a portal hop back to the mothership. How cool is that? Of course, I had many questions about the mothership, especially when I learned how many different beings would be on board. He explained that when the crew is known, they are able to insert modules to accommodate each being according to its needs. There will be birds, insects, amphibians, and all sorts of humanoids on board, as best I understand. I did make sure my module would have a toilet, he said. No problem. Well, that's a good question. Or will I have to go in outer space and do my duty? So they have an indoor toilet. It seems the mothership, at least in the common areas, has a mild temperature setting. But I'll be wearing sort of a mini force field, which will supply me with slightly higher oxygen content than is normal on Earth, with my own temperature setting. There are translation devices far beyond what we have today, which will enable me to speak to anyone on board and vice versa. The crew does not wear uniforms, just the normal attire they wear on their home planets, assuming they wear anything. Oh! Antura says that some beings meet in common areas for meals, and some beings eat elsewhere and join for discussion later. He said I wouldn't want to see some of the eating habits. Even he doesn't wish to. Not sure if I wish to find out too much more about that, but we'll see. And that's the way I saw in Antarctica, where they're eating stuff. They eat in separate places. There doesn't seem to be a real work schedule. Beings work when they feel like it or are motivated to do some specific work, taking readings or whatever they do when they're studying Earth. And Chura says, parking is at a premium, as there can be upwards of 50 ships from multiple galaxies and universes, as we seem to be the big story, switching from the third to the fifth focus. That's never been done before by any other society. It's my understanding that it will be my job to introduce the beings of the Sirius B star system to the people on Earth, as they look so different from the Pleiadians. It's one thing to meet people from another star system whose appearance is very close to yours, but I think there's a fear factor of meeting intelligent beings, and even much more intelligent, perhaps, than you, who look quite strange indeed. Although they probably will not be on his ship, period. No, comma. And Tura says, there are humanoids with horns, some with snouts, some who are 15 feet tall, and others who are very short or even tiny. As I mentioned earlier, they are millions of years ahead of us in technology, but they are not progressing vibrationally, and that's what our contribution to the universe will be, as cataclysms. We will be invited to join this federation of planets. There are approximately 200 planets in this particular group. I'm thinking we've already been invited. And Tour says there are several other groups of federations of planets just in the Milky Way galaxy, all but one of them friendly. This one just wishes to be left alone. But of course, Earthlings like a challenge. So in conclusion, it will be interesting to see if the timeline holds up. The last time I asked Antura, he said it was more solidified than ever. If 2015 rolls around and the Palladians show up, I might start to be excited. But for now, I'm just passing along. Sorry about that. I apologize. I really thought it said what I said. Let's see. Now I'm just passing along some of the many things I've learned from my brother on another planet. And when we come back next week, we will read Power of Mind is the Ultimate Power. Phew! I finished it with 3 minutes left according to my computer clock.
Well, in 31 seconds.
Oh, I forgot the seconds. You must be like that guy. This was pretty good. I'm enjoying his book.
Well, what's the guy's name? We should look him up and see if he's still on planet. I mean, 2015's come and gone. Now, there was all that talk about how it was delayed, if you remember.
Yes. It's Tom T. Moore.
Tom T. Moore?
Mm-hmm.
Tom T. Moore.
M-O-R-E.
Tom T. Moore. M-O-O-R-E. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okie dokie.
See if he's still alive, even.
Exactly.
What year are we? Oh, we're 2019.
Tom T. Moore. Well, he's got Facebook.
Oh, he must be still alive.
Yeah, there's a bunch of books and Tom T. Moore, thegentlewaybook.com. Amazon. But he's got Facebook. Let me go over to Facebook and see what... Oh, it's just the book, I think. We'll see. Tom T. Moore, author.
If we find him on Facebook, we could ask him. Have you met up with the Palladians yet?
Well, he's on Facebook, and I don't... He seems like he's posting. Okay, the problem with closed-minded people is that their mouths are always open. So, let's see what he's
like. Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. 6 hours ago he posted, so he's alive.
Oh, wow.
He's still here. You'll have to get a hold of him.
I'm gonna look him up and ask him.
Yeah. Okay. So, well done on the show.
Thanks. It was fun.
Listen, why don't you give me your son's telephone number so that when he calls, I can message him and say you're on the radio?
Okay, I'll send it to you.
He seems to call every time, doesn't he?
Every time.
But he didn't call back. I bet he went, oh, my God, did I do it again?
I'll send it to you.
Okay.
And you can message him.
Okay. This is Dolly's producer. Would you buzz off? All righty. Say goodnight.
Good night. Well, actually, don't forget to listen to my show, Aquarius. It was special for you.
Yeah, yeah. Right now we got Jamie coming up. Jamie Bates, Expand Your Reality. And then Dolly's going to do a special one for Aquarius.
Aquarius. Okay. Yeah. All right, so we'll be talking the next time we talk, which is, say what, I think on Saturday, 6 to 8. Season 6 to 8.
By the way, our ET friend, Carol, she's going to start coming on monthly with us on Say What.
Oh, yes!
Yep.
Oh, I'm excited!
Judy, it's Judy Carol. I'm going, that's not her name, it's Judy Carol. Yeah,
I knew it wasn't Barb, it was the other one.
Right. So
this is wonderful, I'm excited.
Yeah, so hopefully that's going to all turn out.
Yeah. Alright, y'all. I gotta say bye-bye. Jamie's gotta come on.
I just got a message in Skype from Carrie. Thank you for the Shungite. She must have got her package.
Oh, cool.
Alright, darling. Be safe. Talk to you later.
Alright.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Love you.
Love you.